You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature. On this week's programme, Patricia Baker goes in search of the hidden history of a place behind a locked door in Dublin 8. This is Recalling the Lairs.
The history in this area, this is the oldest part of the city. And the historical importance of this part of the city is humongous.
If you walk around the Liberties in Dublin, you will see this history in the lanes, the street signs, and the fragments of old buildings. I know this area well. I live down the road in Inchicore. I was a student in NCAD, the art college on Thomas Street. I know the shops, the bakeries, the butchers, the plants sold by the street sellers, the bargains and chats to be had along the road.
Nice ketchup,
Graham. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Over the years, I have seen the buildings change as I look out the bus windows.
Okay.
But what really draws me in are the fragments. The fragments of old buildings and walls that make me wonder why they are still there and what story they have to tell. At the junction of Thomas Street, if you turn down Bridgeford Street towards the River Liffey, Oliver Bond Flats on your right, Emma Close on your left, behind which is the Bridgeford Street Park. In the corner of this park, there is an old stone wall that stands awkwardly, that tells of a fading story that exists only in oral histories, old maps and documents, and the remaining walls themselves. I walked with locals, historians and architects to uncover this story that is at the centre of the Liberties, a place steeped in history and destruction. Angela Tobin.
The Lairs of History. Yeah, it's reeking in history. Every brick in Thomas Street is reeking in history.
But like, you walk down Thomas Street and you've got 2,000 years of history just walking down Thomas Street from like ancient Ireland.
Liz Gillis.
It's an ancient road out of Dublin right to the formation of the state in 1922. This area was such a melting pot. Like, I've grown up with a label of the Liberties being deprived from day one. This area is not deprived. This area is rich in people, in culture, in history.
You can do the history of Ireland by literally walking down Thomas Street. You could probably do the history of Ireland walking down Bridgeford Street, really.
Cathy Scuffle.
The outside world looks into this area. And it's propaganda. There's no other words to describe it. Our television programmes, our newspaper media, even social media, give the outside world an image of here that isn't true. And it's all about drink, drugs, deprived, dereliction and desperation. Where the real community isn't that. The real community is history, heritage, culture, craft and the Big C community.
But if you walk down Bridgeford Street and you talk to some of the people who are working and living here, like Angela, Fran and Hilda, they know that. They know what's important and rich about this area.
Home. It's home. The heart of Dublin.
I love where I live. Do you know what I mean? People in this community is what makes the Liberties.
The people in this community are very welcoming. They have community spirit.
Yeah,
they love
community spirit, yeah.
They love their space.
Because you ever see the women, how much it means to them from years ago?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
How much strong, like, yeah. Of love they have for that community. Yeah.
The history matters. It's because you don't want to throw away what you had. You want, actually, you leave your history standing.
And what is left standing? When you walk down Bridgeford Street, what is left of the past? What do you see when you stand at the top of Bridgeford Street and you look down to the river?
And I'm looking down and it's a windswept hill and it leads down to the river, and of course the River Liffey was the beating pulse through the centre of the city. And I see evidence of a past, little fragments of old industry. I see a dual carriageway going nowhere, half-finished road projects that literally hollowed out our area and then abandoned us.
The Liberties and Thomas Street and Mead Street, it's gone through so many changes, even from when I was growing up. Like, we've lost so many buildings that I remember growing up that were just part of the everyday fabric of the Liberties. The skyline has changed so much in the last 20 years. It's happened time and time and time again that buildings, their legacy, what happened in those buildings, the people that were connected with those buildings, those stories aren't important. Those stories are lost for want of advancement.
Bridgeford Street Hill, on both sides, coming up and down, was a little village on its own.
Elizabeth O'Connor.
When I was growing up, there used to be a butcher shop here. And next door was a big garage, which gave local employment. On the corner there, down the road, was two beautiful Georgian houses, which families lived in. There was tenements here. And in behind the tenements, there was little yards, like piggeries, chickens, whatever, little dairies. Like everything else, the buildings were left going to dereliction. Communities that was here all their lives, survived civil war, were moved on. So the community was broke up.
It's the streets that I walk down every day. And you think of the people who walked those streets before you. Like, I'm fifth generation, sixth generation Liberties.
It is the generational stories of the Liberties, the oral histories that tell of another layer of history. A layer beyond the well-documented history of Guinness, Christchurch, Robin Emmet's beheading at St. Catherine's Church on Thomas Street. The stone wall you see when you walk down Bridgeford Street tells of the lost layers. This remaining fragment of a building that dominated this whole area for centuries. A building that no longer exists. Marshalsea Barracks.
Although we don't have the space anymore, it's still in the public's memory. The Liberties, like, you know, people in the Liberties going back generations, they all would have heard of the Marshalsea. So that's why the Marshalsea, the wall of the Marshalsea, you can imagine what was there. But if it's gone and if it's completely erased and the next generation don't know about it, then it is lost. It's like what you say, a person dies twice. They died the first time, but then they died the second time and someone stopped saying their name. It's the same with a building. It's gone.
Hi, my name is Tracy Sands. I'm from Ulverbourne, born and reared, but I now live in Bridgeford Street, or as I like to call it, no one really knows it anymore, Marshall Lane. So where we're standing now is Marshalsea Barracks. Over here is where the block would have stood that my father was born in. Slum tenements they were, really, you know. So he's the youngest boy of, I can't even remember how many children there was, that many. My grandmother had a habit of taking in kids as well. There was always someone's kids in the house being fed. Now, at that time as well, they didn't have inside running water. They would have had, we'll go down this way, they would have had around this area here where the houses are here in front of us, there would have been a block, a toilet block. And we go over here, this was a laneway. And there were some old buildings. It's funny because I still dream about the old building on this side.
And there was a laneway there which they have covered over. There was a pub.
Janet Cullen.
Where you could walk down the laneway and it brought you directly into Marshalsea Barracks.
I used to play up there all the time because this side here, there was big walls. But we would have climbed all those walls because we wanted to know what was inside.
And what was inside those stone walls? The remaining boundary walls of Marshalsea Barracks. Brian Crowley, Curator of Collections at Kilmainham Jail.
The Four Courts Marshalsea, it was kind of the national debtors' prison for Ireland, attached to the Four Courts. So it's attached to a legal institution. And it moved to its location just off Thomas Street in 1777. So in the 18th and 19th century, if you couldn't pay your debts, if you owed money, your creditors, the people to whom you owed money, had the right to go to court, and demand that you were imprisoned until those debts were paid. So you didn't get a sentence. So there's no official end to your sentence until that money is paid. What I find really interesting about debtors' prisons is it feels kind of surreal because it makes no sense. They owed money and your solution to that was to place them in prison where they couldn't earn any money at all and where they were going to spend the rest of their life doing nothing. For many of them, the only release was actually death. And, you know, the fact that society could come up with such a peculiar system. When I first became interested in the Four Courts Martialcy and I was trying to find where it was really difficult because around Bridge Foot Street and where the Four Courts Martialcy, not only is most of the building largely disappeared, but even the streets themselves are gone. And it's really interesting when you go in there now, there's echoes of the past, but it really is quite a faint echo. But then I saw the wall of what turned out to be the ball court, and there was this very rusted old street sign with the Irish and the old Shan Clo saying Martialcy Lane. And that's how I knew that we were in the right spot.
So we're over here now. This is the handball alleys. Hey, sweetheart, how you doing? So this would have been like the handball alleys.
The stone wall surrounds the remaining Martialcy Barracks handball alley. Once an open space, a metal door in the old wall is locked now. The space no longer accessible. Standing on that spot with Tracy, she herself wasn't aware of the rusty little sign. The only remaining indication of what this place was.
Oh, I don't know.
That's Martialcy Lane.
Is it? No way. This was my playground. My whole life was this amazing, amazing story of a debtor's prison.
After centuries of it being a debtor's prison and then a military barracks and then a tenement and that little ball court and this sign is all that's left of that history. So I think what does survive becomes really important. And it is important that we remember that, you know, this isn't just, you know, another part of the city, but this is actually at the very heart of Dublin.
These stone walls and the handball alley they enclose is, as Tracy said, this remarkable story of a debtor's prison. A fading story that no one really knows about. Grainne has it.
It's very layered. It's like a jigsaw with people holding different fragments. Some of those fragments are in people's own memories of their own neighbourhood and their own childhood or young years growing up or walking along lanes that now no longer exist. Other pieces of information are held on documents that people don't much look at or know about, like maps in the military archives. So it's really interesting to find and slowly uncover lots of bits and pieces and realise that there's an incredibly rich history here.
Grainne Hassett's architectural practice is off Thomas Street. She and her team have been part of extensive research, piecing together the history of Martialcy Barracks.
So there's these amazing drawings that the military archive hold here in Ireland, and they're absolutely fascinating. And I suppose in terms of trying to imagine what this was like, in that it has a strong sense of enclosure, by that I mean the walls are very high. So it's like your classic prison yard that you know from films, very high walls, no hope of getting out in atmosphere. What it has is a series of controlling courtyards. And this is the thing that I find absolutely fascinating about the building, is that it's an instrument through built form of controlling capital and people's propensity to lose money and therefore damage an estate for a family. So you come through a series of controlled spatial situations. You come into a first courtyard, which is dominated quite austerely by the governor's house. And I suppose you could say you're triaged almost through that. You can then enter through an archway and down into another large formal squarish courtyard that's overlooked by three stories on three sides. It's not unlike we could imagine maybe the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham in the sense of enclosure of a square courtyard. We've seen that before in Ireland. It is different architecturally, but it's not unlike that in terms of enclosure. So this is where the gentlemen were, and the gentlemen were directly facing the governor and his family, indeed, which is kind of interesting that the family would have been retiring to the drawing room in the evening time, and they would have been directly over overlooking the prisoners, the two sets of people are living together, the free and unfree. All of this is more on the Thomas Street side. And then if we head towards the river, we go into longer, and we've figured out by looking at the angles, probably darker and wetter courtyard. And that's where the paupers would have been later. It's not a very big prison from the point of view of the paupers. It's more dominated by the gentleman side of things. But that court is pretty grim. It's going to be very dark, very high walls. They're all black calp limestone. That's the Dublin calp limestone. And then you go through to another archway and down a whole level, a whole story. So you're stepping down a hill, really, and into this lower yard that's the prison yard. That's the astonishing place that is still existing now. Almost all of the rest of what I described, except for one very important boundary wall, has been demolished, really sadly, and very, very recently.
Now that the physical space is gone, how do we recall the life that was lived behind those stone walls?
Well, as a debtor's prison, let's look at it from that point of view first. We've a fantastic account in a book called St. Catherine's Bells, and it gives an account of a man called Walter Meyer. And he relates in that book that he grew up within the sound of St. Catherine's Bells. And he's talking about St. Catherine's Church on Thomas Street.
The bells that you can hear are not the bells of St. Catherine's Church on Thomas Street. Those bells no longer exist. They were removed in 1970, when the church itself was under risk of being bulldozed for the extension on the roadway that ripped through Bridgeford Street. There are no recordings of the bells that Walter Meyer heard. They are lost. What you hear are the bells of the Roman Catholic Church, St. Catherine's, on Mead Street.
In his life, he runs into financial trouble. Business goes wrong. And he ends up in the debtor's prison in the Marshalsea. And he gives his address at the beginning of the book as a cell in the Marshalsea. So he starts the story from there. But he can still hear St. Catherine's bells.
To accomplish a desirable result, I had a habeas corpus issued and was removed to the Four Courts Marshalsea, Thomas Street. Here, I obtained a large, comfortable apartment in letter C. I was gradually introduced to most of the upper yard and gave from memory the following list. Letter A, hotel for temporary visitors and bar. Letter B, number one, Patrick Donnelly, a Galwayman of noble frame and countenance. He was a sportsman and lodged here from turf transactions. A man about 45 years of age, splendidly proportioned and medium height. Before my leaving, he burst a blood vessel and died, supported by another and myself, universally regretted. Number two, Bat Sullivan, of Golden Bridge Paper Mills. A sturdy, jolly, good-natured fellow, at suit of the revenue for smuggling and assaulting gaugers. His wife, an amiable and lovely woman, lived with him, and his large and interesting family of sons and daughters dined with him every day. The sons carried out the establishment, and they lived in good style. The poor fellow's wife died before I left, and few in the prison who did not shed tears on learning the intelligence and seeing the intense suffering of Sullivan at the occurrence, and the government refused to allow him to the funeral.
What's interesting, he described this kind of variety of different characters, and he says that people end up in debtor's prison for all kinds of different reasons. There are a few classes of debtors, but if we look at the main classes, gentleman debtors and pauper debtors. So pauper debtors are poor people who owe money, who can't clear their debts, but also don't have the means to pay for better accommodation and to support themselves, to feed themselves. Initially, pauper debtors were reliant on charity, and they used to have like a begging bag outside and be reliant on the goodwill of people in the community who would give money for them to be fed. But that became quite untenable, and legislation is brought in that in the Four Courts Marshalsea, because that's a government jail, the Lord Lieutenant is responsible for their care. Those pauper debtors are very much under the control of the authorities because they're so reliant on the government to feed and house them. Some of the pauper debtors will also try in the same way as some of the gentlemen do as well. They try to continue their trades as well. But a lot depends on what you do for a living. So if you are a tailor or a seamstress or a shoemaker, it is possible to keep working while in debtor's prison. Obviously, if you're a docker, for example, or if you're a woman who's maybe a lady's maid and you're not being employed by one of the gentlemen debtors, that's much more difficult. The gentlemen debtors, which could include ladies as well, there were lady and gentlemen debtors, very few lady debtors, they had the opportunity of renting rooms. They could furnish the rooms.
I had my room furnished, which, as I had considerable time to spend in it, was done in a very comfortable manner, including a bookcase with select collection, a good-sized bagatelle table, my case of dueling pistols, and all necessaries for a bachelor's household. I engaged an exceedingly decent, kind and attentive woman, Margaret Nolan, and traveller-like, at once proceeded to put my tent in order.
Basically, they just spend their whole days in this kind of barracks-like building, trying to kill time. So for some of them, that would involve engaging in games and sports. So there's a game called Rackets, which essentially develops in debtors' prisons. Like, its origins are in the debtors' prisons in the Marshalsea. There's a Marshalsea in London as well, but it spreads to Ireland. I think it's really interesting that they decided that's a really important thing to do, that they have to provide something to amuse or occupy the prisoners. And Mailer says, like, he spends hours a day playing rackets and seems to get really good at it.
I at once made myself at home in the community, purchased rackets from McCann, had a gross of balls, learned, became an adept, joined in most matches, and continued playing for about 4 hours a day. Bat Sullivan was a constant player, not very elegant in his style, but his broad, good-natured grimaces covered a number of foibles.
There's a gallery, so people go down to look at the matches as well if they're not playing, again, to pass the time. There was a lot of socialising as well, again, because people had nothing else to do. Prisoners would often invite each other to their rooms for dinner. There was also a tap room for a long time in the forecourts where you could buy beer. You weren't supposed to be able to buy spirits, but there seems to have been no problem with spirits. A lot of parties, you get the impression. And they could also have visitors as well.
At that period, there were few restrictions, except as to time of visiting and the bounds of the hatch. Everything in the shape of liquids was admitted without ceremony, and the governor or deputy governor often formed part of a convivial meeting. My family dined with me every Sunday, and my boy Walter sometimes remained 2 or 3 days with me when he had Sullivan's youngest son, Jemmy, about his own age, to play with.
There's also people where this has been a pattern throughout their lives, that they seem incapable of living within their means. Maybe family and friends, the first few times they're paying off their debts. Maybe after a couple of experiences of them paying off the debts and then them being released and doing exactly the same thing, a decision is made, we will pay for you to have a relatively comfortable life in the debtor's prison, but we are not paying off your debts again. So it has its own kind of community develops and its own kind of rules and customs and traditions. The other source that I would have found very useful over the years are the Inspector General of Prisons reports. So the Inspector Generals are set up in the 1820s. They'll visit every year and they'll comment saying, we were here last year, this has improved, this has disimproved. You know, and you definitely get a sense that some years are better than others. The Inspector Generals of Prisons said to have these two different classes of prisoners together. So it makes it very difficult for the authorities running the prison. They're anxious to keep them apart as much as possible. But the geography, the layout of the forecourts, Marshalsea, mitigates against that, because the hatch, which is this area with which prisoners could deal with people on the outside, where they can talk to family and friends or arrange whatever business they might have, that's up in the upper yard where the gentlemen debtors are. So the paupers have to come up there. And similarly, if the gentlemen debtors want to go and play rackets in the ball court, they have to go down through the lower court. And the authorities don't like the mixing because to a certain extent, the gentlemen debtors set a bad example. You know, they have all this kind of freedom or relative freedom within the prison. But I suppose the other thing about it is it's a very enclosed world. It's almost like having a convent or a monastery in the middle of the area, because the prisoners can't come out. People can come in, but the prisoners can't come out. It defines the area, but also it's a very much a world within a world.
So then later it turns into a military barracks. So rebellion. There was a big fear in Britain that a rebellion would succeed in Ireland. We were so garrisoned. I mean, you only have to look at a map of Dublin and look the old maps and you see all the military buildings blacked out. They're black blobs all over the map. So trace it for me. Coming from the Phoenix Park, you had the magazine fort. At Island Bridge, you had barracks at Island Bridge. You moved up, you had the jail at Kilmainham. You had the Royal Hospital for retired soldiers. You came up the road a little further. Richmond Barracks grounds came up to the South Circular Road. South Circular Road built as the width of a marching battalion so they could get the soldiers out quick. We live with that. And that's all elements of empire still there. And that's what I see when I see all these little hints and clues around us.
After the formation of the state, and because the barracks was no longer in military use, the building was then turned into temporary housing.
Quite similar to Keogh Square in Inchicore, that the army units had been turned into emergency accommodation. Guess what? We had another housing crisis. But this is how we dealt with that. We repurposed old army accommodation. Never fully properly maintained, in fairness. And probably too many people living in too small an area.
That repurposing can be traced in the maps and drawings that Gráinne Hassett has been studying.
The drawings we particularly fell in love with are the ones where we transition into the 20th century, and they're held in the Irish Military Archive. They're fantastic overmarkings of drawings. Something was changed from being an artillery store to now being occupied by somebody called G.M. Byrne, number 2842. So these kinds of wonderful changes attest to the life of the prison changing over to a barracks, weapons store, artillery stores, and then changing on again to the first Irish tenants being there in the Irish Free State. And you see names written in and changing, and you see changes of the plan where women and children are suddenly being thought of for the first time ever. So there's women and children's places to go and wash and that kind of detail.
I remember a friend of my granny's lived in Marshall Lanes, because my granny would often send us over, bring stuff over to her. When I remember with the steps you went up to, into Maggie Stevens was her name. Is that amazing? I remember that. Went up the steps in where she lived, but dark, dank, scary place. There's just one light in it. It'd be in the whole flat. Very dark and open fire. And that's where the family would like, because there's nothing else really at that time.
Rudimentary, I think, adjustment for life, but they would have been largely as they were, really largely as they were built in the late 18th century, in fact. There are some maps that show us where a telephone was attached to a wall. They did have toilets outside in a yard, separated for women and children. See, for instance, this one here that says one washhouse and two band room means that on the ground floor, the first level, is the washhouse, and on the second level is the band room. And we know that that's a later development, and that before that, this place that is being described now as a washhouse and a band room was a church, was a Roman Catholic church. And so that changeover is an incredible thing to begin to think about why and how that happened. I surmise, but I haven't got evidence of this, because, of course, you have to remember all of this is demolished.
We had this push in the late 70s, early 80s to, if you like, clear this type of accommodation and improve the lot of the people who were living there. And then I just remember it being closed up and bit by bit disappearing. Bits of it disappeared from the landscape. But it had the fine stone walls, the Dublin limestone, actually, probably locally quarried, probably quarried up near Dolphin's Barn.
It was an incredible loss here, really, really incredible loss in so many ways. Obviously, it was a huge loss of culture and history, but there's also a huge loss of material. You know, there were tens and tens and tens of thousands of bricks. Never mind all of the Dublin Calp limestone that was in the surrounding walls, and but they were swept away. That's a huge loss as well as all of the other losses. I mean, it's a place rich with fascinating story.
Like, we're talking about a building that was built in 1775, that stood for 150 years. Even when we were kids, you would have walked down the laneway that's not there anymore. Like, that's my abiding memory of just this big imposing wall, this tiny laneway, and then this big imposing wall. And you're like, God, what the hell was that? And then I'd go back and ask my dad, going, Dad, what is that place? And then he'd tell me about it.
Fragments of stories passed down through the generations. When it was all removed, there were no official markers or information retained. For Tracy, all she recalls is the empty ground where the barracks once stood.
But around here, it was derelict. This hole where you see houses around us now was just a field. I didn't know what the field was. I knew that it was a place for adventure and playing. We didn't realise we were climbing over the walls of an old army barracks. And I certainly didn't know that my dad was born there and, you know, had his first years of his life there. Growing up in the 80s around here was amazing. You know, when they built Oliver Bond with 2,000 or more residents, they didn't put any playgrounds in, so we had to make our own fun. Unbeknownst to myself and my best friend at the time, who's sadly passed, we were playing in all this history and we didn't know. We were jumping on the stones and jumping on the rocks. We just seen it as somewhere you could go and get blackberries. Almost, if you like, how like children in the country do. This was our country. This was our countryside. It was very overgrown.
The field now houses Emma Close and the Bridgford Street flats. The ball court, surrounded on four sides by the stone walls, which are classified as protected structure and extend south to Thomas Street, are all the remains of Marshalsea Barracks.
So what we have now is really beautiful and really resonant. It's such a pity, though, that there's, on one hand, so little of it compared to what was, because what was really quite remarkable as an incredible instrument of the city, a huge piece of history of the city. Right now, we have the boundary wall of that. We have, we could say, 50% of it.
Standing at the walls with Gráinne, you get a real sense of the history and scale of these stone walls. And you can hear the metal lock of the door echoing against the stone.
And you can see the height of them if you look up. You know, they're really three stories high and more. Beautiful calp limestone with some bits of sandstone and through it, the yellow is lovely sandstone as well. So very surprisingly intact and very, very strong. The engineer, structural engineer who looked at it, Lisa Eden, thinks they might have been built a very typical military construction where you build two outer skins of wall and you fill it with rubble inside. And they're tied together with cross. Only really people interested in construction would be interested in this. Tied together with cross stones that cross the cavity. But these walls are a metre deep at the base. Amazing feats of engineering, really important pieces of engineering. And we don't have as many pieces of military engineering, let's say, in this country that we should be interested in preserving, and this is one of them. But of course, you know, we're on a hill, so there's a whole other story above us, and that's the case. From the past as well, the pauper's part would have been a whole story above, towering over and looking over, indeed, the exercise yard. So that would be a funny situation, actually, where the paupers could see out of their windows the gentlemen playing racquetball as well, and then the paupers and the chaplains and everybody was going through under the paupers building and down the steps and into the church, and which was a Roman Catholic church, mixing with the gentlemen and their audiences who would have been watching them playing racquetball. So there's a real intermingling of activity that I find fascinating, which is played out in space, up steps and through courtyards and under arches. Quite a strange mix of people spatially bound together.
These stone walls enclose the remaining former gentleman debtors' racquetball court.
And then we have the complete enclosure of the former exercise yard. Now, it was a former exercise yard, but it was also a number of other things at different periods. It contained a drying area for clothing, contained later on latrines and washing areas for women and children. And then it has these two fantastic other things, one of which completely improbably as a Roman Catholic church, a old church built in the middle of a, or to one side of an exercise yard, which has now disappeared. And then what we still have, which is a granite-faced gentleman's ball court, also quite an astonishing thing and the only one of its kind in the country, as far as we can tell anyhow.
When it was opened, the ball court was a playground for the local children. Liz O'Connor.
I was about 5 or 6, and my brothers used to play over there before the flats were built over there in the houses. That was a big field, just a big open field, and all the kids out of the flats used to run over there and play. And we'd go into Marshall East to the ball alley. No, I was too small to play, but I remember the bigger boys playing handball. But the ball alley had a huge part in the kids growing up on both sides of the street, because a lot of the bigger lads, they were really very good at handball. And if there hadn't been a handball league then, if it hadn't been a national sport, like it is now, it's a sport now, there would have been some champs coming out in flats because they were brilliant. But anyone that used to play in there, they put their names on the wall between the ball alleys. So a lot of the lads whose names are on that wall have since passed on. So it's great to see the names there and to think that they're remembered. They won't be forgotten.
And people kept horses there. And at one point, we know that the church was being used as a youth club as well, and being used by the local community in a number of different and useful ways for animals, for people, for socialising, for the youth.
All these stories are just in fragments, in maps, in oral histories and in archives.
Again, fragments. There's still bits of it there, still emotive enough that you can sense all of those pasts.
I mean, that's a fascinating thing, because we, the architects, have a particular fascination with drawings and tracing through what might have happened here. But it's when we started to talk to people in the area and hear them saying, I used to walk down that lane on my way to school, or my mother wouldn't let me go over there, or I remember that wall was very high. And then to look at old photographs, whether they were in the 70s or whether they were much earlier, or 1950s aerial photographs also showing abattoirs and pigsties. And it's when we looked at all of that and thought about people actually living their lives through these walls, walking by them to school, or being afraid to walk by them, or meeting a boyfriend there, all the kinds of ways in which people play out their lives, and realising that these are the backdrops to people's lives. They can't be swept away. When you sweep them away, you sweep away people's memories and their very identity of how their lives are constructed and lived. You can do it maybe once, but actually in this area, what is particularly tragic is that this happened at least 3 times within my living memory, actually. So we see the widening of Bridgeford Street for the street widening programme, the potential threatening of St Catherine's Church, which is incredible that it would be considered. We see the construction and then the demolition of the modernist block that is Bridgeford Street Flats. Very incomprehensible, really, because people would have moved from the Marshalsea barracks into those flats for, a new future. And then 30 years later, those very flats were knocked down again. So they grew up in one place, developed memories in one place, fell in love, you know, lived and died in one place, moved to another place, enacted their lives again in another place, just over the wall. And then that's demolished as well. And then, you know, we have a construction then that happens of the latest block of social housing, which obliterates, sadly, the original lane lines and the original shape of the Marshalsea block. So we start to lose further historic traces. It's incredibly important that we don't lose that thread back to ourselves, because we become very unstable in our understanding of what our neighbourhood is and what our identity is. Maybe it's worth just even saying that people in country areas will appreciate what this feels like when a new motorway comes through, for instance, what might have been good farmland or might have been a historic hill, and these kinds of places that people understand to be of significance in the country. It's exactly the same here in the Liberties and the wider area of the Liberties, where there's a certain instability in the urban fabric, and when things keep getting swept away like that, it makes it even more unstable, almost as if the tide keeps coming in and sweeping things away and taking them out again.
It's only little pieces of our heritage that's left. Everywhere you walk down Thomas Street, there's a story to tell. Yeah, the layers of history. And every little alleyway in Thomas Street, like, it's all layers of history and layers of history down them lanes. I love my history. I'm Mullinahack and all. It's just a name that was out hundreds of years ago, Mullinahack. It's a great name. It's all down Cook Street, all up by Oliver Bond Street. That was all Mullinahack. I always remember my ma saying it. There used to be a shop there in Mullinahack. All right, ma. Just wish I got a confirmation dress made in Mullinahack. And do you know what's down there now? A hotel. A hotel. See, this is what I'm trying to say. They're building hotels on air heritage. Do you know what I mean?
It's very fragile. And how do we retain the layers of history and then make it useful for modern purposes? This is the challenge. But we've got to start respecting things a little bit better around here. It's not all about bulldozing it out. Some things have remained the same. Fragments are there for us to find. The cultural heritage is there, touchable. But it's also in the voices of the people, the accents of the people, the surnames of the local people. All the little hints of history are there. That sums up intangible cultural heritage. Layouts of streets. The sense that we make it work for our society today as the people in the 1700s. Use the same layout, same streets, almost same buildings to do their way of life at the time. That's cultural heritage. We're inheriting it, keeping it going.
There's nothing in school. What we learned about our history is true our parents, our mothers and our grandmothers.
The children are dependent on their grandparents or their parents to tell them and remind them of what was here, but it's all I know.
It's the older generation, you know what I mean? And when they go, what's left? Who's going to tell what this is all about? This is our history, you know?
And I learned the history from listening to people singing the rebel songs in the flats when I was growing up. Oliver Bond. I was born over there, and then it was Sunday morning, we had one neighbour, Mrs. Johnson, that I haven't worked, and she had a gramophone record thing. And she used to come out every Sunday morning and put it on the balcony, and she'd be playing all our gramophone records, and she'd be playing Mary O'Landa in 78. I always remember that. Mary O'Landa and Elton Eddy. The music was brilliant. That's where I got my love from opera from listening to that. And then we had a man who used to come in, I think he was a traveller. And every Sunday morning he'd come in and he'd stand and he'd start singing up to the blocks. Beautiful voice. And people would throw over the penny or whatever to have a halfpenny to him. But that's the memories, that's the history that we had. That no matter what you had or where you came from, you were embraced in this area because everyone was equal. Everyone came together and everyone stood together. But the music was always there and the stories. And we had neighbours over there that lived into the 90s. I remember years ago saying, why doesn't people record them? Because their memories are memories that we'll never get back and keep the memories going. That for the next generations coming up, they can listen back and say, and they can visualise what it was like. Because the liberties is changing, the whole face of the liberties is changing. All the family homes is gone, you have apartments, you've stayed cities, you've hotels popping up everywhere. There's no community element there now. It's all commercial. So that's all gone. And unfortunately, it was never recorded or preserved.
Why does it matter so much to preserve and tell these stories? I was reading a book by Anne Enright, The Wren, The Wren, and I came across this line.
We don't walk down the same street.
As a person walking beside us.
All we can do is tell the other person what we see.
We can point out our things and try to name them.
If we do this, well, our friend can look at the world in a new way. We can meet.
The idea that if we share our histories, recall our layers, point out what is meant by each of the names in the walls and the fragments that are left, we can meet.
Can I ask you one more question? I asked you at the beginning when you stand on top of Bridgeford Street, what do you see?
If somebody stood on top of Birchwood Street, a stranger, what would you like them to see?
I'd like them to see the community. I'd like them to see the people that's walking up and down that hill every day. To ask them and stop them and ask them what they like to live in here, what they like in this area. Come in and ask, how old is the flats? What was there before the flats was there? Same at Bridge Street, what was on Bridge Street? Ask the history. And that's what it's all about, Tricia. You're welcome, Tricia.
Thanks a minute.
Recalling the Lairs was presented and produced by Patricia Baker. The programme was a Curious broadcast production for RTE Lyric FM, supported by funding from Cumashun na Mban and from the RTE Independent Radio Productions Unit. Sound mixing was by Brian Fleming of Contact Studios. Music was by Jerry Horan. And extracts from letters and other correspondence were read by Damien Kearney. The Lyric feature is available to listen to or to podcast from various well-known podcast platforms and also from the RTE radio app and, of course, the Lyric feature's own webpage, which you'll find on the RTE website. You can contact the programme with your comments or observations, features.lyricfm@rte.ie.